Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The traditional celebration known as Old Home Day has been bringing northern New England rural communities together now for over 100 years. Every summer, throughout the region, organizers arrange gatherings and events for as little as a single day or as long as a whole week to show off the best of what their small towns have to offer. Families reunite, long-lost natives travel home, and dances, fun runs, fireworks, and parades are the order of the day. Gary Crooker has been chairman of the Old Home Day festivities in Wilton, New Hampshire, for almost 25 years.
That was like a whole weekend of being at the state fair. The parades always consisted of floats. You'd see the same people working on three different floats because they belong to one organization in town and work someplace else, or you'd have a neighborhood float. It's really just a chance to say again, you know, we're a community, we live together, and you know, we just feel that's more than just a bunch of people that live next door to each other. We have a lot of people come back to town. That's something that I don't think we've lost any ground on at all with Old Home Days. People do take that opportunity. They've gone on to other things, but they have their roots here, they grew up here, and they do come back.
Old Home Day began as Old Home Week in 1899 as part of an urgent effort to bring people back to their native towns, if only for a visit. By the end of the 19th century, New England's rural communities had suffered decades of steady population drain, especially among the young. Lack of opportunity, the lure of America's industrialized cities, and the promise of the expanding West all contributed to the decline. New Hampshire Governor Frank Rollins hoped that Old Home Week reunions would convince one-time residents to return, remember all that they had missed, and perhaps move back for good. It didn't really work. Small towns continued to struggle and stagnate, but the idea took hold anyway, and the tradition has been faithfully preserved ever since.
Today's Old Home Day celebrations are more like local fun fairs than the civic festivals they used to be, but New England's hamlets are generally more prosperous now and certainly more populated as well. Still, New England's rural towns face many challenges as they head into the 21st century. Today on Storylines New England, we turn to a novel that captures the Old Home Day experience and New England village life. We'll look at our region's small towns, their decline, their revival, and their continuing struggles. Once again, Gary Crooker.
I don't think people ever, when they're making a journey back to their old hometown, at least initially, are going to look at too many changes as being for the better, because they're looking to come back to the place where they ran along the railroad trestle and talked with each other about how boring it was to live here. On the other hand, I think once people have been back for a while and look at things, that a lot of times they will say, yeah, you know, it's more diverse. The employment opportunities here and in the area are much more diverse than they were 30, 40 years ago. So they will, in a lot of ways, grudgingly admit that there are changes for the better, but changes overall, I think they're looking to see what hasn't changed when they come back.
From the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Canoy. Storylines is a special 13-part radio project of the American Library Association that looks at the literature of New England as a way to better understand who we are as New Englanders and Americans. We've turned to Robert Frost to explore New England's landscape, looked at our region's political influence through Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, and examined the plight of our cities in the pages of Michael Patrick McDonald's All Souls. This week on Storylines, we turn to rural New England, its decline, and its revival, as we read from Edith Wharton's novella, Summer.
In 1917, Edith Wharton offended, excited, and intrigued readers with her classic novella, Summer. Even for its time, one of vastly expanded opportunities for women from suffrage to college education, Wharton opened up new territory in American fiction with her bold and honest depiction of a young woman's sexual awakening. Summer is the story of Charity Royal, a New Englander of humble origins, yet a proud, passionate, and forthright person who risks everything in a torrid love affair with an upper-class outsider, Lucius Harney. The book crossed boundaries that many books before its time dared not approach: abortion, sexuality, and childbirth out of wedlock. It unsentimentally observes class conflicts and the social and moral hypocrisies of small-town life.
But above all, Wharton's novella captures the plight of turn-of-the-century rural New England, a region that had become, in the American popular imagination, unappealing, if not downright unpleasant. As the story begins, Charity Royal, 17 years old and blossoming, is clearly stultified by her life in the tiny western Massachusetts hamlet of North Dormer, a town with no shops, no theaters, only a church that opened every other Sunday, if state roads permitted, and a library for which no new books had been bought for 20 years, and where the old ones moldered undisturbed on the damp shelves.
"How I hate everything," she murmured. The girl walked along, swinging her key on a finger, and looking about her with the heightened attention produced by the presence of a stranger in a familiar place. What, she wondered, did North Dormer look like to people from other parts of the world? She herself had lived there since the age of 5, and had long supposed it to be a place of some importance. But about a year before, Mr. Miles, the new Episcopal clergyman at Hepburn, had proposed, in a fit of missionary zeal, to take the young people down to Nettleton to hear an illustrated lecture on the Holy Land. In the course of that incredible day, Charity Royal had, for the first and only time, experienced railway travel, looked into shops with plate glass fronts, tasted coconut pie, sat in a theater, and listened to a gentleman saying unintelligible things before pictures that she would have enjoyed looking at if his explanations had not prevented her from understanding them. This initiation had shown her that North Dormer was a small place, and developed in her a thirst for information that her position as custodian of the village library had previously failed to excite.
Edith Wharton was an outsider to New England herself. Born and raised in New York's high society, she summered for 10 years in Lenox, Massachusetts, in a palatial mansion that she built called The Mount. By the time she wrote Summer, she had already left New England altogether for the bomb-blasted countryside of World War I France, where she assisted humanitarian aid efforts while continuing to write. In spite of this removal, Wharton's rural New England rings true, just as it does in her earlier, more renowned novel, Ethan Frome. Both stories capture our region at one of its lowest points, when dullness, decadence, and destitution were thought to be the principal features of life in rural New England. Since Wharton's time, though, small-town New England has rebounded, and people have come back, settled, and even prospered. Yet today, many still fear for the future of villages like the fictional North Dormer, as the divide grows between rich and poor, and outsiders challenge and dilute long-standing traditions and cultural attitudes.
Today on Storylines New England, we look at Edith Wharton's Summer as a way to explore New England's rural life. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Are you from a small town? Do you live in one now? Did you leave for a time and then return? What do you think the appeals and the challenges are in small-town New England today? And does Edith Wharton's writing strike any chords that harmonize with your own experience? Again, our number here on Storylines, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477.
And we're joined in the studio now by Barbara Will, a professor of English at Dartmouth College. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Keith. Nice to be here.
And from Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, it's Carol Singley, an associate professor of English at Rutgers University, Camden. And she's the author of Edith Wharton, Matters of Mind and Spirit. Hi, Carol.
Hello, Keith.
And Carol, I want to start with you. What does the novel Summer tell us about the way New England rural life was seen at the time it was written in 1917?
Well, I think Edith Wharton loved New England, but also saw it as very isolated and not necessarily the best place to nurture a young girl's budding interest in the world and her own womanhood. I think Edith Wharton found in New England great respite and great opportunity, as she wrote about her house in New England in Lenox, a home of her own. She felt that growing up in New York society, She was never completely at home, but when she had the opportunity to design and construct her own home and to live among the beautiful hillside with views that she had, she felt at peace and she felt that she had found herself. When she depicts Charity Royal, she's working in two directions at once. She's working with a girl who wants to be independent and who would like to be able to leave the small town in which she lives, but who has conflicted feelings about her ability to do so. And she also works with a character who comes from a place that's different from the small town, the rugged mountain area, which frightens her and also makes her feel somewhat ashamed. So Edith Wharton is dealing with a complicated set of issues about origins and being at home and trying to leave home.
Carol, do you think we read this book differently today, given the attitude toward New England that prevailed in 1917 and the one that we tend to have now?
By the one that prevailed at the turn of the century, I think Edith Wharton is capturing a certain sleepiness in the town she calls North Dormer, which is just north of sleep.
And Dormant, right.
At the same time, she's celebrating the beauty of nature, which she finds to be completely harmonious with Charity's awakening to her own sexual desire. Mm-hmm. And so in respect of nature and its benefits to the soul, I think we find a constant here, and I think Edith Wharton early identified it. I think she was somewhat capturing, as all realist writers do, a time period when so much change in the outside world had made a small town like North Dormer seem forgotten and had made the inhabitants of small towns feel rather despairing of their possibilities. One of the first things Charity says in the novel is, "How I hate everything," and she longs to escape. And I'm not sure with the current technology and communications whether so many people would feel that isolated and lacking in opportunities as Charity felt at the time that the book is set.
I want to pick up on a theme that both of you have raised, and Barbara, we'll bring you into it. It's this theme of sort of New England as a place of decay and a place where you really don't want to be. What were the causes of this sense of New England as a kind of deadbeat place that you wouldn't want to go to?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not totally sure of what the sort of specific economic or sociological causes were, but certainly there was a sense, especially among writers at this time, that America in general and New England in particular, New England having a sort of deep history of being a place where writers had been nurtured, since the beginning of the 19th century, that New England represented a certain kind of American literary tradition. And a lot of writers at this time, Wharton included, were leaving New England and leaving America in order to go to Europe, feeling that they needed to get away from the restrictions, a lot of the kinds of cultural restrictions that you see in a town like North Dormer, these molding books, the sort of, I always think of this phrase that Wharton has used of lives unlived, these sort of people with limited horizons, imagining a sort of a limited kind of future for themselves, and that's reflected in the kinds of cultural opportunities that they had. And I think that Wharton and other writers also felt that New England was a place that was really sterile in terms of creativity and couldn't really nurture writers.
You know, you talk about New England writers and intellectuals leaving for Europe, and also at that time people were leaving to go west because the frontier was opening up. But even within New England at this time, Barbara, there was a hierarchy of towns. Mm-hmm. You know, this town was at least a better place to be than that town. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk a little bit more about that hierarchy.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's curious because the town that is seen as the place to be in summer is Nettleton, which is actually an interesting kind of place name, because it is associated with nettles, which appear in the novel in kind of as kind of a disturbing reference. She talks about nettles as Charities on her way up the mountain. But I do think that Nettleton, which is actually based on Pittsfield, Massachusetts, in Wharton's imagination, represents a little more of a kind of cosmopolitanism than even North Dormer. North Dormer, of course, represents more cosmopolitanism than the mountain, which is this kind of primitive, primeval place where people just are sort of caught in this Hieronymus Bosch kind of experience of savagery. But you're right, there is definitely a hierarchy within these small towns. But I'm not sure Wharton is necessarily saying that even a place like Nettleton is better, really, than North Dormer. And I'm sure we'll come back to this, but there's a very important speech in the middle of the book where Lawyer Royal talks about needing to come back to small towns because, in fact, it's the smaller towns where you get more vitality, you get more of a sense of hope, and you get more of a sense of authenticity. And so there's this way in which Wharton is also valorizing the smaller places. And I think that's interesting, too.
He certainly complicates his descriptions of what is going on in Nettleton, even as he kind of glamorizes what's happening there. Mm-hmm. It's also the source of abortions and prostitution and other very dark things. Carol Singley, there's a hotness to the town of Nettleton and the things that go on. And Wharton herself called Summer her hot Ethan in reference to her earlier novel, Ethan Frome, because of its alleged sexual explicitness. Can you tell us a little bit of something about what this sexuality amounted to in the novelette Summer?
Well, a lot of critics see Edith Wharton's writing as situated in a long struggle, a protracted effort by women for women's rights, and women had not yet gained the vote, and they did in 1920. There was a long effort underway to free them of double standards, and Edith Wharton was keenly aware of some of these restrictions. And in choosing to write a coming-of-age story about a girl named Charity, she takes a few departures from the norm. She's writing a seduction story. Charity becomes prey or vulnerable to Lucius Harney, who is well-intentioned but will marry in his own class and ultimately sees Charity as someone he has a summer fling with and then leaves behind. And Charity will also be confronted by her own guardian, Lawyer Royal, who accosts her one night, knocks on her bedroom door, and Wharton is working with women's options within the construct of Charity's own home and small town and her own family structure. And what makes the novel interesting, and a lot of writers have used this device, is that Charity is an orphan. She has been adopted into the royal household, and after 7 or 8 years, the adoptive mother dies, leaving her with her adoptive father, who she eventually marries. And Edith Wharton is working with a long tradition of sentimental literature in which a heroine is tempted and may fall, and if she does fall, experiences some kind of ruin, or if she's redeemed, experiences some kind of proper marriage and legitimate inclusion in some social structure. And she's taking some pretty radical departures from it because she's playing with notions of incest, even though Charity is not marrying her actual father. She's
right.
Marrying her guardian father.
Yeah.
And she also is playing with a woman, a young woman, who rather proudly and defiantly makes decisions on her own behalf. One wouldn't say that Charity is a complete victim, although we know that her circumstances make her very vulnerable to the overtures of Lucius Harney and set her up for abandonment by him. But Charity makes a lot of conscious decisions, and she's in many ways a forerunner of a progressive woman, a modern woman who tries to take matters into her own hand. And this is part of the hot aspect,
right,
of the novel.
So she's really working against that 19th century tradition, isn't she?
I think so.
Yeah. Barbara Will, how much of a shocker was this sort of depiction of a young woman at the time it appeared?
Yeah, I think it was quite a shocker. And you know, it's of a piece with other texts, other books that were written at the same time, like Theodore Dreiser's Sister Carrie. And it's really interesting to compare those two, I think. But in any case, I think Wharton was really writing a shocking novel at this point. I mean, the sex scenes aren't anything that to a modern audience, to a contemporary audience, would seem particularly shocking. But in that day and age, they were quite explicit. But there's also this imagery, constant imagery of sort of sexual release. And, you know, there's a scene with fireworks that's very erotic. And I think, I mean, Wharton's just playing around with that all the time in this book.
She is marvelous at implication, isn't she?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I think that's exactly right. Wharton is saying as explicitly as she can what it's like for a young woman to come of age sexually. And she's not making a simple case of Lawyer Royal. He's a very complex figure, and Edith Wharton claimed when she received commentary about the novel that he was the book.
Mm-hmm. I remember reading something about that, and we could probably debate that one for hours. Is the book about summer? Is it about New England? Is it about Lawyer Royal? Is it about charity? Carol Singley, I really want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Carol Singley, Associate Professor of English at the University of Rutgers University, Camden. She's author of Edith Wharton, Matters of Mind and Spirit. You're listening to Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Kevin Gardner. And today, we are looking at New England's rural towns, their demise and revival, through the pages of Edith Wharton's Summer. It's a coming-of-age story about a young woman's life in a stultifying Massachusetts village called North Dormer, shortly after the turn of the century. Join us with your calls, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Do you live in a small town now? Did you come from a small town and escape, as Charity Royal wished she could? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. We also want to know what you think is appealing about life in these tiny New England villages, and what do you think is unappealing? Again, our number on Storylines New England, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest for the hour, Barbara Will, professor of English at Dartmouth College. And joining us now is Cynthia Mill Duncan, sociologist and founding director of the Carsey Institute for Families and Communities at the University of New Hampshire. Cynthia is also author of Worlds Apart, Why Poverty Persists in Rural America. And Cynthia Duncan, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you study poverty. That's your field of expertise. But you have, as I understand, just finished reading Edith Wharton's Summer. And I wonder, from your perspective, how the poverty depicted in the novel Summer compares to rural poverty that you see today.
Well, it's interesting because the depiction of the mountains really is not like what I found in contemporary rural New England. I had also looked at Appalachia and the Delta, where poverty was much deeper, and the kind of stereotypes, you can find elements that are true, although certainly the mountain picture and all of the rumors and kind of fear and the idea that they were moonshiners as a way to live is the kind of stereotype that people often associate with rural, and that I think a lot of rural sociologists and others who look at rural communities try to get to a more deeper understanding than those stereotypes present.
And Barbara, for people who haven't read the book, just what is the mountain that looms in this book, Summer?
Yeah, it's a place, a very specific place, where Charity Royal, the protagonist of the book, the main character, comes from. And she's taken from this dreary, very poor, very destitute place and brought to this larger town to, you know, become a proper lady.
Larger town being
North Dormer, which is already, you know, about as small as you can get if you're not in the mountain.
And just give us a physical description of the mountain, because I think, Barbara, it's a physical and psychological presence on the village of North Dormer.
Yeah, yeah. It's really just, it's like a barren crag, really, that's just hanging over this place. One of the things that strikes me in the book is the way Wharton consistently describes it as a place that gathers bad weather around it, so that, you know, you've got clouds constantly collecting around it. And every time a character tries to go up to it, you know, some kind of bad weather starts to happen, rain or ill, sort of like a bad feeling in the air. The people of the town are, or even of the settlement, I suppose you'd call it, are just, you know, remarkably sort of poor, destitute, and I think she actually presents them in a rather critical way. I mean, I was disturbed by a lot of the portrayals of these characters because they seem as though they're just soulless and immoral, really immoral. And I think she's there's a disturbing way in which she's connecting poverty and a kind of working class with a kind of poverty of spirit and a poverty of imagination.
We have a reading now read by Stan Cahill from Edith Wharton's Summer. It is Mr. Royal, Charity's guardian and eventual husband, talking with her love interest, Lucius Harney, just about those folks up on the mountain.
The mountain? Why, mountain's a blot. That's what it is, sir. A blot. That scum up there ought to have been run in long ago. And would have, if the people down here hadn't been clean scared of them. Mountain belongs to this township. It's North Dormer's fault if there's a gang of thieves, outlaws living over there, in sight of us, defying the laws of their country. Why, there ain't a sheriff or a tax collector or a coroner durst go up there. When they hear of trouble on the mountain, the selectmen, they look the other way, pass an appropriation to beautify the town pump. The only man that ever goes up is the minister, and he goes because they send down and get him whenever there's any one of them dies. Oh, they think a lot of Christian burial on the mountain. But I never heard of their having the minister up to marry them. And they never troubled the justice of the peace either. They just herd together like the heathen.
And Cynthia Mill Duncan, that's one of the most vivid descriptions of this underclass, the mountain dwellers in the novella Summer. Does that jive in any way with descriptions that you have heard or with research that you've done about poor rural people today?
No, it really doesn't. I mean, there are certainly, and I would say more in the persistently poor areas that are even more isolated than rural New England, folks who are so destitute that their lives are unfathomable to the people who live in the county seat or the larger towns. People in northern New England refer to the poor as those at the end of the road. And I imagine, and really Barbara, of course, would know better than I, that Edith Wharton wouldn't have had direct contact with the poor in her time and in western Massachusetts. But one thing that I found in the northern part of New England where I did my work is that there were fewer stereotypes than in Appalachia and in the Delta, and that there was, although there was isolation, there was the kind of, and it meant that people will know your business, just like Charity discovered when she went to watch that night, and everybody knew that she'd been out and been by the house where Harney was. But I think that there's also this... the smallness translates into taking care of each other, which you also see by her being adopted. And you see that today.
And Cynthia, we're going to talk a little bit more about that. Excuse me for cutting you off. More after a short break. Rural New England and Edith Wharton's Summer. I'm Laura Canoy. You're listening to Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Thank you.
From the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Each week on Storylines, we look at a particular New England author's work as a way to try and better understand who we are as New Englanders, where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading. Today, we're looking at Edith Wharton's novella, Summer, and the history, revival, and challenges of rural New England. Summer is the story of Charity Royal, a small-town girl living a humdrum 17-year-old life in the fictional town of North Dormer, Massachusetts. That is, until a stranger comes to town, a young architect named Harney, and the two get involved in a passionate love affair, despite their social and economic differences. Wharton's work was regarded in its time as both intriguing and a bit scandalous. It was one of the first works of American fiction to deal honestly with a young woman's sexual awakening. Yet her book also offered the stark picture of a struggling New England, empty, outcast, and ambitionless, a region that had reached its low point.
Although New England has seen a revival since the days of Wharton's Summer, many small towns in the region still grapple with the challenges she described. A greater divide between rich and poor, a brain drain of young adults leaving for higher education and then for good, and a lack of suitable jobs. But there are those who stay, and many more new arrivals. They find something in these small towns worth staying for, a sort of patriotism for their town, despite the better opportunities that could possibly exist elsewhere. In Edith Wharton's novella, that person who stays is Charity's guardian, Mr. Royal, the middle-aged lawyer who, during North Dormer's old home day, addresses his fellow citizens on this very topic.
Gentlemen, let us look at things as they are. Some of us have come back to our native town because we'd failed to get on elsewhere. One way or another, things had gone wrong with us. What we dreamed of hadn't come true. But the fact that we had failed elsewhere is no reason why we should fail here. Our very experiments in larger places, even if they were unsuccessful, ought to have helped us to make North Dormer a larger place. And you, young men who are preparing even now to follow the call of ambition and turn your back on the old homes, well, let me say this to you, that if ever you do come back to them, it's worthwhile to come back to them for their good. You must try to make the best of it, and to make the best of your old town. And after a while, well, ladies and gentlemen, I give you my recipe for what it's worth. After a while, I believe you'll be able to say, as I can say today, I'm glad I'm here. Believe me, all of you, the best way to help the places we live in is to be glad we live there.
Today on Storylines New England, we're reading from Edith Wharton's novella, Summer, and we're looking at rural New England, its decline, its revival, its appeal, and its challenges. We want to hear from you with your stories of small-town life. Call us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. What are the difficulties facing your town? Did you find its life too constricting? Did you leave and stay away for good? Or did you change your mind and return to the rural life once more? Or are you new to your small town? Again, join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
In the studio with us, Barbara Will, professor of English at Dartmouth College, and on the phone, Cynthia Mill Duncan, sociologist at UNH and author of Worlds Apart, Why Poverty Persists in Rural America. Let's take a call, this first one from Johnson, Vermont. Bob is on the phone. Go ahead, Bob. You are on the air. Welcome to Storylines New England. Go ahead, Bob.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to first comment that we're very much enjoying the program. My wife did her thesis on Edith Wharton when we lived in Rhode Island, and so we're very excited to hear this. But we thought it was appropriate to call because we live in Johnson, a small town in the mountains. Having left Providence. So we certainly know Newport, which was another venue for Edith Wharton, of course, and the Providence area is a very large metropolitan area. But we deliberately picked up and moved here. And
how come, Bob?
Well, we, among other things, it was just a matter of a life change, life choice, and we found what I think we were seeking, which is a place where one can have some control over one's life. And for example, I'm now on the planning commission in this small town, and we find that this is a place where people know their neighbors, where you can depend and call on your neighbors, and if one takes the trouble to become involved, then one can see the results very directly.
There are a lot of people like you, Bob, huh, who are moving from cities into small towns in Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine and so forth.
Well, there seems to be that, and of course there are those tensions, you know, where the newcomers, you know, they tell us here in Vermont that it's going to take us four generations to become We've got a while.
Is that all?
We've got a while to wait, I think. But so, you know, there's that can come up. But we find that from town meetings to, you know, just local events, whether they be parades and old time, parades or just events to raise funds and so on. For example, we had the firehouse burned down recently in Johnson. So the community effort to pitch together.
Everybody got together. You know, Bob, you raised something. Hold on, because I want to ask Cynthia Mill Duncan something that you brought up because it's very interesting. He talked sometimes about the tension, Cynthia, from the many, many newcomers who are moving to small town New England, escaping that city rat race, and the people who are already there. And I wonder about those tensions, you know, as rural New England gets more gentrified, people buy up old farmhouses and make them into these fabulous homes. What happens to the people who were there already, even the people on the very low end of the scale, the so-called mountain people?
Well, it's a delicate balance, really, because in many ways, New England is fortunate that it's what the people at the Department of Agriculture call a high amenity area. In other words, the reason that our caller wanted to move there is because not only the small townness, but it's a pleasant, beautiful place to be, and that's true of most of rural New England. What I hear from people is that there are people will call summer people, summer natives, if they've had a good relationship with the longtime residents and have really pitched in the way that our caller does. And then there's this, as you can imagine, kind of delicate balance of how well people are able to show their respect for long-term residents and not try to come in and remake the neighborhood from, in this case, Providence, but be sensitive to not just appreciative of what's already there, but sensitive to the long-term residents and what their interests are. So I know of some cases in rural New England where people with the best intentions have moved in but haven't been respectful of the efforts and abilities of the people who are there, and their efforts to be engaged have been rejected. There are people from away who are just disdained, are not regarded with any respect. And in other cases, people come in and really commit, and although it does take, people still say it takes several generations, people see in what you do an ability to respect the people who have been there for a long time and want to work together. And so there, you know, there's a real continuum of how well the people from away are able to negotiate becoming part of this community without destroying it in the process.
And we will bring up this theme of insider-outsider frequently during the 13 weeks of Storylines New England, when we talk about Peyton Place, when we read the works of Annie Proulx. But what's so interesting to me, Barbara Will, is there are lots of people like Bob from Johnson, Vermont, who move from big cities to rural New England. They love, you know, what it offers, as our caller tells us. And yet, when I read Summer, it was so different then. You know, New England, again, was the last place you would want to move to. It's it's a complete change in about, what, 90 years since the book was written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, New England is the place you just have to escape if you have any wits about you, or if, and especially if you're a woman. I mean, it's a place that represents this horribly stultifying kind of soul-destroying life. I mean, I'm not sure what the demographics are. I agree that Wharton wants to emphasize the sort of the horror of small-town New England life, or the stultifying aspect of it. But on another level, she's also talking about it as a beautiful place, and Charity is very much rooted in this place. She's constantly referred to as a flower, and the beauty of her location in that summer kind of setting is emphasized over and over. So I think that comes back to what Carol was talking about very early on in the program, about how Wharton herself was drawn to this setting and saw New England as being a very refreshing, beautiful place to be, especially as a sort of wealthy, homeowner who could just go in during vacations from New York or from Europe. So Wharton has a kind of ambivalent attitude about small-town New England as
well. She certainly is equally capable of showing North Dormer as a place of terrible isolation and even personal spiritual danger, just as capable mm-hmm. as she is of making it a nurturing place mm-hmm. that is essential to a certain kind of spiritual development. We have another reading that gives us our heroine, Charity Royal, in one of her few moments of calm and happiness, and it's a reading that shows her getting away and communing with nature a bit.
The street upon which she emerged was still empty, and after glancing up and down it, she began to walk toward her house. But instead of entering, she passed on, turned into a field path, and mounted to a pasture on the hillside. She let down the bars of the gate, followed a trail along the crumbling wall of the pasture, and walked on till she reached a knoll where a clump of larches shook out their fresh tassels to the wind. There she lay down on the slope, tossed off her hat, and hid her face in the grass. She was blind and insensible to many things, and dimly knew it. But to all that was light and air, perfume and color, every drop of blood in her responded. She loved the roughness of the dry mountain grass under her palms, the smell of the thyme into which she crushed her face, the fingering of the wind in her hair and through her cotton blouse, and the creak of the larches as they swayed to it. She often climbed up the hill and lay there alone for the mere pleasure of feeling the wind and of rubbing her cheeks in the grass. Generally, at such times, she did not think of anything, but lay immersed in an inarticulate well-being.
And that is Brenda Foley reading a little section of Edith Wharton's Summer. You know, it's just a wonderful measure of Wharton's subtlety and power as a writer that in that little passage, which is one of the most positive passages in the book, she manages to get the word mountain into that set of sentences more than once, just to remind you in the background of the what the origins of this young woman are.
It's always looming there.
It sure is. It's there in one way or another. Let's take another call. This one is from Jean. She's calling from Northfield, Connecticut. Hi, Jean.
Hi.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. I grew up in Northfield, Connecticut, a village of 350 people, which is in the tax town of Litchfield, and a very beautiful area. Beautiful with nature.
Uh-huh.
It was, in a way, a place that you needed to get away from.
Yes.
To grow up. And somebody said once about Northfield that it was known for the number of valedictorians and the number of out-of-wedlock pregnancies. Different ways of trying to get significance.
Jean, did you ever feel a bit isolated growing up in Northfield?
Yeah. But one thing that happened was there was a lot of energy to be put into the church.
Mm-hmm.
And because we didn't have the competing pressures, we weren't in activities at Litchfield, we had a lot of energy. And the church youth fellowship became very, very strong. We were meeting at the church perhaps three to five times a week during the time when we made Christmas wreaths. And the members of the Pilgrim Fellowship became the church custodians, and we returned the money we were paid back into the church. And we had a youth group that is always remembered. But Northfield was a great place to grow up, and it's still my home.
Well, thank you, Jean. Cynthia Mill Duncan, let's talk about isolation for just a moment. Edith Wharton has a masterly way of conveying a sense of isolation. How is it that groups of people in small towns, whether they're rich or poor or different classes, isolate themselves from one another, even within small towns occasionally?
Well, it's interesting because what Jean was telling us was how important those social networks that she had in church were mm-hmm. to making it a good place to grow up. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something most people think of nostalgically about rural areas, whether they grew up there or it's what they're imagining. And that isolation is from not only, you know, the glittering lights of the big city, but also from economic opportunity. And we really haven't talked that much about economic opportunity, but that's what drives so much of how things go in rural New England today. The lawyer Royal was so eloquent about committing to the place, but of course he was a lawyer and he could put together some kind of life. And the reality is that as jobs in the woods and the other side of the love of the natural environment that wonderful passage that you had read describes is the ways in which the economy is tied to natural resources. And in New England, what we've seen is primarily the woods and the mills and manufacturing places that the rivers have supported historically. And now what we're seeing is an enormous change in the kind of employment that's available, so that the wonderful natural environment that brought Edith Wharton and her friends to Lenox and others to northern New Hampshire or to coastal Maine still are bringing people, but the base of the economy and the mills that provided a good middle class livelihood for working class people and that shaped the character of the place are no longer as plentiful as they were.
Wharton is at some pains to say that even Lawyer Royal's legal business is not exactly a red hot bonfire.
Exactly.
He has to go to Nettleton to do some work, which is kind of in a sidelong way referenced by Wharton as vaguely distasteful. As you look at poverty today in rural New England, do you see that technology, transportation, other things that we take for granted in the modern world have made any inroads in economic opportunity for people in backcountry towns?
Some, but not much. I mean, I think there's still a lot of hope and promise, but what most people who look at rural New England today see the future is in tourism and second homes, and there's a greater emphasis on cultural heritage and trying to draw out the history that is interesting and made the place what it was at one time. But there are still, if you look at the statistics, and they're not good statistics, there isn't the, it's harder to get access to the internet in rural New England, and transportation is still a problem. It's hard to get from one place to another. You need a car if you're going to work. Schools are consolidated, so kids travel a long way on buses. There's a wonderful new report out right now by the Annie Casey Foundation on rural Northern New England and children and how they're doing, and really the theme is that the economy is changing in ways that aren't providing opportunities at the same level that were available in the 70s and 80s, and so that's people are trying to figure out how you can build a good vital community and keep opportunities to move into the middle class when those middle-class jobs aren't there anymore.
And just very quickly, Barbara Will, it's interesting what Cynthia says about tourism, because tourism is huge in New England today. It's everywhere. And again, so different from Wharton's time. I think at one point in the book, Charity Royale says she asks Lucius Harney, her love interest, why would you want to come here?
Right. He's got some kind of money to come and look at old buildings, and she can't figure out why he'd want to look at old buildings when he could look at perfectly new buildings. You know, why is he so interested in these old buildings? But yeah, I mean, I think she's picking up in many ways, this novel is interestingly situated in terms of a change in the relationship of people to New England. I mean, I think that's why it's so interesting to talk about it right now, that she really is definitely sort of looking at the sort of burgeoning of this tourist movement, of which she herself is a perfect example. I mean, she was one of the, you know, wealthy tourists who went to Western Massachusetts.
Right, and she summered there. Mm-hmm. She had this fabulous house.
Yeah, and the house, by the way, whose name was The Mount, which picks up on that whole question of the mountain, too, and, you know, the sort of the doubleness of her life there. But, yeah, she was fascinated by that transition of New England from a primarily industrial kind of place into a tourist kind of mecca.
That we see today.
Yeah.
Let's take another call. This is Margaret calling from Benson, Vermont. And go ahead, Margaret. You're on Storylines New England. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I'm Margaret Zales. I'm Paul Zales' mother, the co-producer of your show.
Great.
And we came here 7 years ago from New Jersey, and we fell in love with the place. There's only 900 people in the town and 1,200 cows. We lived on a dirt road 7 miles off on a lake, so we thoroughly enjoy it. We are retired now, and Paul was up here to visit us when he was getting, you know, started with the program, so he loves it too. So
a lot of people, Margaret, are retiring to New England, right?
Right.
There's a lot of you out there, and I've seen a lot of press about retiring to New England. You know, usually, Cynthia Mill Duncan, people retire to Florida or someplace warm where they won't have to shovel snow. But Margaret's part of a trend, isn't she? A lot of people are retiring here. How is that influx of retirees affecting life in rural New England?
Well, again, as I said earlier in the show, I think it depends a lot on the on who's coming and how they're able to negotiate their relationships with long-term residents. I've been away from New England for the last 4 years and just recently came back, and I have to say I've been really struck by how many people now are talking about McMansions, whereas it wasn't a trend before.
Right.
The part of the second home and vacationing world that Edith Wharton's generation represented has continued right until the present. But what's new is this retirement, as you say, people choosing New England and small rural communities over Florida. One thing that they clearly bring is the often an interest in being civically involved, and they can be an enormous resource to a local community. And they need services, and they, they end up making the occasion for new jobs. And I think that one reason northern New England's rural areas are different from, say, Appalachia or the Delta of Mississippi is because this constant influx of people, both just for summer and starting in the 70s more permanently, people looking for small town living, has been a good thing in northern New England. It's bringing fresh ideas, people who want to serve on the school board, do the kinds of things that our first caller talked about. But it isn't automatic because home prices can go up, and certainly in coastal Maine you see a lot of fishermen who can no longer live close to where they need to put their boats in, and people worrying about a working waterfront. So it's, you know, it's a complicated transition that I think New Englanders are really trying to figure out how to make it be a good thing and not a net cost.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned working waterfront. Later on in Storylines New England, we're going to be looking at those issues through the book of Spartina. Thanks, Margaret, for that call.
There's no question that the negotiation between old-timers and newcomers is a very complex dynamic. Let's take another call. This is Linda. She's calling from Montreal, Canada. Hi, Linda. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Fire away.
I lived in the Northeast Kingdom for 17 years,
small town of Guildhall. I raised three children, and two of my children went to Brook Mountain Academy because they were ski racers, and my daughter made the U.S. ski team. And I enjoyed living in the Northeast Kingdom very much. It's just, it's very beautiful. I lived on 140 acres of land, had to learn how to drive on dirt roads, under bad road conditions. But I've recently returned to the city, and after 17 years, and I realized that this experience has changed me permanently and for the good, and for the very good.
Sounds like you came from someplace else to be in the Northeast Kingdom and then returned to a bigger place. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Why'd you leave, Linda?
My family, my son actually is going to school in Montreal, and my mother still is alive and lives there. And I got a divorce, and I just decided that I, for some reason, wanted to go back to where I grew up.
Sure.
But I've been permanently altered by this experience, so I'm not the same person. And so it's an adjustment getting used to a big city again.
Do you miss things about your little small town that you used to
live in? Oh, absolutely. I really do. It's very true. There are a lot of hardships, and my husband was a surgeon and had to manage some of the logging accidents and some of the motor vehicle accidents where young lives were snuffed out, the moose collisions, et cetera. So there were a lot of tragedies that I saw, but nonetheless, I was very impressed with the people that live there. They're very independent, very, very strong, and they're survivors. They really are.
Thanks, Linda.
Cynthia Mill Duncan, very quickly, does that sound like a typical story to you? Small town, big city, small town, back to the big city.
Well, it is something that you hear about now and again, and I think we, as people who study trends in rural America, need to understand better who's leaving and who's coming back and who's leaving for good. One of the things that's an interesting kind of counter trend to the retirement and second home folks that we've been talking about is that increasingly you also see lower income families moving to rural areas because costs are lower. And again, if they have any way to support themselves, whether it's transfer payments, Social Security, or Medicare, or some kind of way that they don't need to find jobs or they can live on less, they might be moving there because costs of living are lower.
Well, Cynthia, I'll have to cut you off there. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Barbara Will, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. For more information about Storylines New England or the books in our series, visit our website at storylines.ala.org or your local public library.
Storylines New England is produced by Keith Shields. Our engineer is Andrew Walsh, with production help from Dan Colgan, Rebecca Kaufman, and Ty Fraley. Brenda Foley and Stan Cahill performed our readings. Library discussion guides were written by Bill Ott. Georgia Lomax coordinates the participating libraries.
The executive producer of Storylines America is Paul Zales. Storylines New England comes from you to you from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Kanoy. Join us next week for Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Next time on Storylines New England, scandal, gossip, small-town hierarchies, and Grace Metalius's Peyton Place.
Almost 50 years ago, Peyton Place rocked the nation as Metalius blew up the region's Norman Rockwell facade, exposing a place where violence, incest, even murder occurred after the sidewalks were rolled up at night.
We'll look at the social dynamics of small-town life and the impact of Peyton Place on the next Storylines New England.